What makes this job a good fit for you, and what, to your mind, makes you a good fit for this job?
I think, like, firstly, obviously, I view Canada as my second home. You know, I got married there, little boy, born in Canada. And obviously, I have a good knowledge of the landscape, the players, the system. So that, first of all, I think makes it an attractive place to come back. I can see that this team is on the cusp of, you know, going even one better than what they've already achieved. It's got a rich history in the women's game. And then I think for me personally, the second thing really, when I came to England, I was very clear that my next move was to be a number one, a senior head coach. And, you know, over the last 2 years, I've spent my time just solely working with senior players to win. So put those two things together about being a number one and understanding the country, loving the country, it was a perfect reunion.
Bev, as specific as you can, what is the difference between being a number two and being a number one, and how do you learn to be a number one?
Really good question. I think, you know, for the last 2 years, it's the only time really that I've only been a number two, so I can definitely tell you maybe the difference of being number one. I think ultimately the buck stops with you. I think that's the first thing, that the pressure, the scrutiny, and ultimately you can put a great team around you, but your neck is on the line, and I think you have to make big decisions that ultimately you'll be looked at for those decisions. So I think that's definitely one. I think the second thing is the leadership part. So trying to paint a picture, the clarity, everyone looks for you for that clarity. That's really key. I think as a number two, you support someone's vision and someone's clarity, but you've actually got to be able to articulate that and take people with you. That, for me, is the difference, the pressure, the scrutiny, and then, I guess, a vision, a clarity that you have to bring, and you have to have everyone else sort of singing off that same sheet, really, to articulate that, believe in it. For me, that's probably the two biggest differences.
What was the biggest difference you saw in the evolution of the Canadian program under John? And I don't know how much you kept track of it under his replacement, under Kenneth Heiner-Muller. But kind of, look, you know, there's still some big personalities and still some big names who are around the team that were there when you were with the team, Christine Sinclair being one of them. Mm-hmm. But how has the team changed since, you know, even since perhaps you first started working with John?
I think, you know, I can talk probably more closely to when I left, but I think the real blend of experience, and you've got sort of a middle-aged group, you know, if I think about, you know, Ashley Lawrence, Kadisha, Jesse, that middle ground, and then you've got these young guns that, you know, have come through a system a bit more and are trying to break in. So I think the blend is there. Probably compared to when John first took over, it was probably more of an ageing team. I think with that blend brings a new type of player. But what they've got is they've got a really solid foundation, values that have been held since, you know, even before John took over in the older players. So I think that blend is key. And then you look at the landscape now of the players and where they're playing. You've also now got people who've been brave and, you know, took themselves off out of their comfort zone beyond even just an NWSL, gone to Europe, etc. So I think there's like a varied experience that you put that together and you tap into it, and I think it can be quite unique.
Bev, I look at the FIFA World Rankings and understand that, you know, played in a while, so, you know, rankings could sort of change quickly if we ever get to a little better place in the COVID universe. But, you know, the teams that are ahead of Canada right now, the United States and Germany and France and the Dutch, where do you think the Canadian program is in relation to the teams that you ultimately want to beat, as you said, to get a different color medal?
I think those teams that you just listed there, they obviously they have a strong domestic league, but actually in fact now where the women's game is at, you've got a bunch of players out of those teams now playing in one or two leagues. And I actually think that, obviously, a lot of the Canadian players now, it's moving that way as well. I think that's certainly one thing. You go at what Canada has rather than what they haven't. For me, they've got a really strong system, or they've had a strong system that's transitioned a group of players. So I think, for me, if I go, what do I think the group needs, or, you know, where can it go? I think getting back to what they are, like, who are they? What have they evolved to? Because they've come on a journey, obviously, since I've left. But just being really clear about what they're about and just keep evolving what's been put in place. I don't think the gap is major. You know, with England, we played Canada, for example, just before the World Cup. That was a tough game, like one of the toughest games we have. They beat England. England had a bad day as well. But regardless, for me, the gap's not big. It's the little things now, and probably the mindset and really being clear what it is we're going after. I think those things are going to make the biggest difference. And I think it's just an evolution, really, of where it needs to go.
Richard referenced the pandemic. And, of course, one of the things that every coach is dealing with, certainly national team coaches, is the uncertainty surrounding the international fixture list. We're hoping the Olympics will be played in Tokyo in 2021. How difficult, Bev, is it going to be to try to incorporate everything you want to do at a time where schedules are clearly in flux? And who knows what happens if we go through if the second wave hits even harder in the spring or over the winter. How are you going to go about trying to do what you need to do with that impediment?
Yeah, good question. I think there's two parts to this. I think some of the learnings I've had from being in England and the European sort of, I guess where the women's game is going, club football is massive, and the domestic environment is massive. So we only have them together, really. And if you talk about developing players and them getting better individually and then the team part, like, I think working with them within their domestic setting is really important. So through coaches, through player connections, through watching the games and giving them feedback, like all of that sort of stuff. I think it's no longer just an on-camp model. I think it needs to be an on- and an off-camp model, and we do both of them things. And then secondly, I think because of COVID, and if I look at, again, what the opportunity is, yeah, we might not have a game coming up immediately, but that actually buys a little bit of time for me to personally connect with the players, understand a bit more, and then really be clear, I guess, what we are going after when we are next together. And then it means we can hit the ground running. So I agree it's not fantastic circumstances, but at the same time, there is opportunity. And I think getting a really connected, clear group so that when we get on that first training pitch, it's really clear and the girls can actually just enjoy themselves on the football pitch.
We're joined by Bev Priestman, head coach of the Canadian women's national soccer team. Women's soccer has taken tremendous strides internationally, not just in Europe, but also in the United States. The women's league was actually the first North American league to sort of successfully get up and running after the pandemic and successfully conclude its season, which was, you know, tremendous credit to all involved. But I'm wondering, as we've seen the women's leagues evolve, domestic leagues evolve, whether it's in Europe or in the States, have there been some tactical and strategic changes and maybe even, I don't know if physical changes is the right word, technical changes in the women's game overall, Bev, as a result of the development of domestic leagues? Has it kind of changed some of the tactical thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I think even comparing, you go NWSL and WSL, where I am in England, like two fantastic leagues. You see in England probably more an influence from the men's game and the connection of those teams to a men's club. So I'll use Man City, where Janine is, as an example. What you see on the pitch generally as an overall style is aligned to what the men's looks like. So you have a real tactical influence there. NWSL, I would say, it's like the most competitive league. You know, you can't pick a score mm-hmm. in many ways. You can't predict it. Really tight margins, probably physically more demanding than the WSL. So I think it's not one league over another. They offer different things, and it's got to be right for each player. But absolutely, I think the men's game influence is a trend. And, you know, as a coach trying to predict maybe what 2023, 2024 looks like, you have to look at major tournaments and the men's events, because I do think there's a trend that the men's event happens, year later you can start to get on top of the curve, as well as looking at the most prominent men's coaches, you know, like a Pep Guardiola or a Klopp. Like, their style and influence is having an impact on the women's game. You can see that. So any aspiring coach will be watching football, doesn't matter whether it's men or women. So I think it's definitely a shift. It's harder to score goals. It's definitely more tactical to watch. And obviously, as a byproduct of that, girls are training with world-class players every day. They're obviously improving technically too. So it's about getting our players in good environments to do that.